J.O. Howard. And my comment is the following. A couple of years ago, I got a microprocessor based smart charger. And unusual for a piece of equipment to explain what it does. Evidently, it does exactly what he was talking about. That it starts out with a high current, it monitors the voltage. As the voltage approaches the number of cells times the cell voltage, it slows up. But then something very interesting happens. What it does is it occasionally pulses a little more current in. And the interesting thing is, evidently when the battery hits the point where it can no longer take more as a chemical reaction, the voltage for an increasing current actually goes down by, oh, perhaps 50 millivolts. It senses the voltage going down with an increasing pulse of current and says, I have charged this battery properly. And while it can monitor temperature, it only does that as a safety. Over to you, then.
Yeah, I used to do the exact same thing, Howard. I have a 4.5-digit digital voltmeter, which I would put across the terminals that I added to my ICOM charger, MC35 or something like that, I think is the model number of the charger, which I've got to repair. Anyhow, I would notice that when I'm in the fast charge mode, I could see the voltage come up fairly rapidly, and it was putting, I believe, 600 milliamperes into my great big pack. I'm trying to remember what model number is that particular one. I'm looking at the battery right now. It's ICCM8. I forgot how many milliampere hours the CM8 is good for, but it's an awful lot. And as the battery came up to full charge, the extra charge will start creating heat, and you'll notice that the climbing voltage that you experience will start folding back. When you've got 4 digits or 4.5 digits on your digital voltmeter, you'll see the voltage begin to decrease. And that's a sign that the temperature is increasing because the voltage that will appear across the cells, as they increase, that voltage will drop, even though when they're under charge. There's a catch, though. You've got to hope that all of your cells in a series pack come up to full charge at the same time. If some of them are still coming up to charge while the others are overheating, you may not be able to sense the full back of current, of voltage, and therefore you may miss it, so to speak. So getting close, what I tried to do with my studies of voltage versus time and so on, I tried to judge it in such a way where I charge my cells rapidly until I get to what I think is 80% of charge. Then I flip the switch that I added to that charger so that it goes into the trickle mode, and then for the next X number of hours, a significant number of hours, with a trickle charge, all the cells are brought up to full current, and now no one cell is getting an amount of current that's creating a significant amount of heat beyond the point where they're fully charged. So rapid charge to the 80% point, trickle charge after that, was my successful technique, where I've had, at times, a battery pack last me like 5 years, and I use it every single day. So care and feeding of rechargeable batteries, as I said before, it's a bit of an art and a science. And if you have any further comments before we go over to Bernie, give me your call letters right now. KQRIW on the TechNet. Okay, nothing further. Let's go over to Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar. What would you like to talk about tonight, Bernie? KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Jeff. I've got an RFI problem, and I'm looking to see if anybody has experienced this before. And this, I've got a very high noise level in the house here in the VHF range, and it's fairly marked. And anyway, earlier in the week, I got to troubleshoot a little bit. I shut down the whole house power lines. My office is in the house, so I've got a lot of people here around, so there were a lot of suspects. Anyway, I shut the house down and was able to troubleshoot it down to one area, and it's actually just a telephone system for my business. It's an Nortel digital key system, and it's the KMQ and the voicemail system. I was putting out a very strong signal in those about 146.650, I believe, right around there. So I'm just curious if anybody has ever dealt with trying to quiet down a digital telephone system.
Wow, that sounds like a tough one. You would think Nortel wouldn't do that. So it's a Nortel telephone system making a significant hash, if I'm saying you correctly, at 146.85. Is there a way that you can put the telephone system into various modes of operation, making a call, receiving a call, recording, whatever? Does it have an uninterruptible power supply? Have you ever seen any change in the amount of noise by the Nortel phone system as a function of hour of the day, mode of operation, operating on its UPS? I mean, there are some phone systems, for instance, which have built into them an uninterruptible power supply where the wall plug is continuously charging the battery, but the battery is continuously going into an inverter, which is generating the power that the phone system works on. That way, no relay switching time is required when the primary source of power becomes interrupted. It has always been running on the inverter of the uninterruptible power supply. I'm not convinced that's the most reliable method of working, but something do that. So before we proceed, Bernie, have you ever seen any change in the amount of hash as you do anything to the system that makes a change? K2IO, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Well, the answer is no. I haven't had time to study it much. I think it was out on Friday and came back to more shows on Monday. So obviously, one of the first things we're going to check their ratings and see what they are, in fact, covered under or what they do. I have noticed a varying degree of how much of this noise is available. I mean, when it's really bad, I can have F7, F8 on the repeater input at 146.85. Then literally I'll have to turn fully up once I'm close enough to the repeater output that it will break itself and that's the headache. But it is just obnoxious. I usually get upset enough about it to go looking for it, and then it'll be gone the next day. And so it's been a very odd and frightening experience in this state. I'm also going to take the voicemail offline. And does not have a CBS on it now, but it would be interesting to try to plug it. I'll move it to the CBS and see what that does for it.
And that's worth a try. Also, there's methods you can use, even if you are in love with that phone system, and maybe that particular model always does it. There's two things to concern yourself now. Your particular serial number of that Nortel phone, is there an error in it, or is it something that's generic with that particular whole product line? But in either case, you can drastically decrease the amount of noise you hear by increasing your desirable signal-to-noise ratio. And what you can do, if for instance you're normally operating with a handy-talkie and the handy-talkie rubber duck is operating, you know, 3 feet away from the phone system, any noise the phone system is making, you're so close to it by inverse square law, you're getting a fierce amount of the electromagnetic interference, the RFI, radio frequency interference. If you added an external antenna to that site by putting an antenna in the attic, an antenna on the roof or whatever, and running a cable down to your handy-talkie and plugging the cable into your handy-talkie, you would benefit three ways. Number one, the antenna up high outdoors is going to get a hell of a lot more signal from Limock and every other repeater you might want to talk to. Number two, the antenna has a phase center that's further away from the source of noise. And number three, you've got the shielded cable going from your point of contact of the handy-talkie all the way up to the roof. So by two or three procedures, you will make a huge improvement in signal-to-noise ratio if you're able to use an external antenna. And even if the external antenna can't be up high, if the external antenna can be a piece of cable going to an antenna that's in another room, again, by the inverse square law, by the fact that you've separated the point of reception further in feet away from the source of noise, means you'll be getting a lot of less of the noise. Each time you double the distance between you and the source of noise, you'll get one quarter of the amount of noise power. So even before you correct what may be an error of that particular phone system, there's something I think you can do in the meantime. And that external antenna I'm talking about, it could be a very simple coat hanger antenna, which is $2 worth of hardware plus a length of RG58 cable. It could make a huge improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. I wonder if that makes some sense, Bernie. K2IO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, that absolutely does, and that's part of how I've just kind of lived with it for a year and a half now, but I figured I'd finally get around to actually looking at it. What would you recommend for how to actually measure the noise per se? I've got a couple of settlers that have this exact same system, and I was thinking during this week I'll go out and kind of measure, sniff around there to see if they're putting out this kind of frequency. What's the best way to measure it? Is it AM noise? What do you recommend?
Yeah, you're not going to like the answer to this one, Bernie. The only thing that's traceable to the Bureau is microvolts per meter. If you have an antenna of known gain, and if that antenna is held a known distance that you can measure from the source of noise, and if then you have the right kind of instrumentation that measures the dBm of power received by that antenna at that range, at that frequency, and you go to the right calculation, you can boil it all down to what is the real radiated EMI, electromagnetic interference. And the units of electromagnetic interference are microvolts per meter. You ain't going to like it. I didn't say it's easy, but that is the standard traceable to the Bureau. There's a certain number of microvolts per meter that every piece of instrumentation should not exceed. I don't know the number. I know that when it comes to susceptibility, a good chunk of electronics should not go haywire when it sees something like 10 to 100 volts per meter of incoming signal. So a good handheld device in the presence of other radio equipment, like transmitters, should not jump off the table when it sees either 10 or 100 volts per meter. But when it comes to electromagnetic interference, which is measured in microvolts per meter, it's not completely easy. You tell me what you're using for an antenna, you tell me how far you stood away from it, and if you can make an estimation of how many bars you got on your handy-talkie, on its signal strength meter, its RSSI, receiver signal strength indicator, and if you then calibrate that with a signal generator, step by step you can get the number we're talking about, but as you can tell, there's a lot of steps involved, and it's not super easy. K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, that definitely makes sense. Now that's to prevent the FYL if you want to use a service monitor. But how that's going to happen for this problem. But yeah, what I was doing was using an old AOR standard with this standard antenna set on AM. I was getting, call it F7, F8, and then just doing some plug drop down to F2. So I powered them on and off multiple times, or you know, I literally pulled the plug out. This was the television question. I mean, was to figure out which breaker it was in the house, and then what that breaker said, and then what was on that breaker. The difference is there are only three things on that breaker, so I was able to sort them pretty quickly. Anyway, thanks for the info, and I'll, what I'll do is just throw my AOR scanner and my toolkit when I go out to these sites and set it next to them and see if they're sending that kind of noise. Anyway, thank you much, and I'll drop back to the video for KQIO Brandy.
Yeah, if you know something about the antenna, the nature of the antenna that's on the AOR, and if it's got some kind of a bar chart, signal strength indicator, S-meter, or whatever, and if there's a way you can then get to a signal generator and put standard amounts of signal into the AOR and find out, you know, S1 on the AOR equals 1 microvolt. If the S-meter on a piece of instrumentation was really calibrated of the way the definition says, 50 microvolts is supposed to be an S9 signal. That's the definition of S9 on a signal strength indicator that goes from S1 to S9 and 20 over 9 and 40 over 9 and 60 over 9. S9 is supposed to be 50 microvolts. Each individual S unit is supposed to be half the number of microvolts. So when you go from S9 of 50 to S8, it's supposed to be 25 microvolts. S7 is supposed to be 12.5 and so on. So very few ham radio pieces of equipment have an S meter that's that well calibrated. But no matter how well it is uncalibrated, you can connect it to a signal generator and find out what the readings mean. So by a step-by-step process, you can get a good ballpark figure for how many microvolts per meter is coming out of the device. As you continue this investigation, Bernie, sure wish you would come back and tell us what you find, whether it be successful or unsuccessful. You've got a very interesting story, and I think we'd like to hear a little more about it. So please come back in the future. Now back to you, Bernie, for any other comments. Okay, stand by for a second there, Bernie. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just interestingly enough, coming back to EMI lab last week, the FCC Class B limit for emissions in a 2-meter band coverage area is 30 dB microvolts measured in quasi peak in a 10-meter chamber. So that's kind of interesting because from the numbers you were just mentioning, S7 is right around around that area of rough cut. Back to you, Bernie.
Yeah, but you
got to
be careful now. 30 dB above a microvolt. 30 dB above a microvolt would be 1,000 times more power than a microvolt, which is roughly 33 microvolts. Yeah, I see where you're going here. It's a round S8. You're absolutely right. On a well-calibrated S-meter. So, that may help. Over to you, Bernie, for any other comments. K2LIW.
Well, Glenn, I thank you. That's an interesting point. So we could actually be looking at that if, shall we say, at the legal end of purchasing. So we just have to live with this. That's okay. And then we'll start looking at Bill Faraday to go over the phone system. I'm going to play around a little bit this week, experiment with the cables coming out of it, maybe shorten up one of the tails, pull the tails off of it. I'm a telephone guy by background, so I can experiment with it quite a bit. So I'll pull the feeder cable to come out of it, make sure that none of those happen to be at resident length or something that's making it work. So I'll experiment with it, and I'll let you guys know. It'll probably be a couple of weeks. Good news is I'll be off in Dayton next weekend, but I'll be back in 2 weeks, and I'll give you some feedback. We'll see what happens.
Can you give us one more comment?
Yeah, thank you, Bernie. Glenn recognized. We'll be thinking about you spending all that money in Dayton, Ohio, buying all those goodies. You don't have to put a Faraday cage around the telephone system. Even if they're right at the legal limit and they won't correct it, you can drastically improve the signal-to-noise ratio by installing an antenna at some other location, hopefully a higher location, or even just an antenna draping out the window of that particular building. But just that the antenna is further away from the phone system, and it's in a locale that picks up a lot of signal from 146.85, for instance, and then that cable comes up to your handy-talkie, and you connect it to the handy-talkie while you're in that room with that phone system. That's a beautiful way of drastically increasing the signal-to-noise ratio, where hopefully you won't even hear the phone system anymore once you receive it from a better location. So have the benefit of having your handy-talkie at the top of the building, so to speak, even though you're not really there, because you've installed an antenna and a cable there. That's one approach. Glenn, go right ahead.
Yeah, just one thing I wanted to mention, too, is looking at the cables, like you're mentioning, coming in and out of the phone, that's also a really good idea, because a lot of times when we're making measurements over the lab, whether it be J.C. Brown or, you know, over at UL, one in Melville, so many times the cables make such a difference. I mean, I've seen as wild a difference measuring the output stuff coming out of equipment. 15, 20 dB difference just between a shielded cable and an unshielded cable, or just even the position of the cables are routed along the floor or next to other pieces of equipment. So even that in itself might moving the cables around or maybe even getting a better shielded cable might be some of the problems too. Faculty, KC2, do you like this?
Yeah, what you're talking about is shielding the hot cables, adjusting the lead dress, as they say. In most cases, when a piece of equipment is radiating signal, the wiring going into it is the antenna it is using to do the radiating. So there's ways that you can drastically decrease the amount of radiation. You can stop it from having an efficient antenna system by way of its external cabling. Putting ferrite beads in the right places and whatever are many of the techniques. Bypass capacitors and so on. The ceramic bypass capacitors. Now we're starting to climb into the design of the equipment itself, and there you got to go slow. Okay, the person who wanted to be put on the end of the list was Rich, N2EO. Go right ahead with your comment, Rich, K2LIW.
Hello, Glenn. Check, don't forget me, WQEWK.
Okay, we didn't hear you sign in, but you're going to be right after Rich. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Jenkins, so we, last week I caught the tail end of the TechNet. You were discussing 6146B output tubes, and some reading I've been doing and some experimenting I've been doing, I wanted to pass along a little bit of information on the newer rigs of the 70s, like Kenwood 520, the 820, the 530, the 830. Those rigs were originally used what the Japanese called an S2001A, which is, as far as I can see, is electronically equivalent to a 6146B, as in Baker. When I was doing repair work up until 92, I used a lot of 6146Bs in those rigs, and also on some of the Yaesus, like the FT901BM, let me let it drop. And it worked out fine. On the Collins stuff and the Hallicraft is in the stuff of the 1960s, you can't, believe it or not, you can't use a 6146B. Some people do, and in some research I did, the 6146, the 6146A are very similar, but they, what the parts is the 6146B, which is actually a very different tube. From what I've been reading, you got places selling 6146Bs and the ruggedized version, the 6146W, and the people telling people to use them in stuff like Collins and some of the other rigs of the 60s. In these rigs, you have to use either a 6146, a 6146A, or the preferred tube is actually called the 6293, which was used as a pulse modulator in radar equipment. The 6293 is electronically equivalent to the 6146A with a heavier plate structure, and they work out extremely well in the Collins KWM2. So I just wanted to pass that along, because what I've been reading, it's my own findings seem to agree. You put a 6146B into the Collins, either they don't neutralize right, or the neutralizing tends to drift. I don't know why, I don't know what's different about the tank circuit. You can't use the Bs in the older rigs of the 60s. The preferred tube is a 6293. Second choice would be a 6146A. Third choice a 6146. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, Texas, Imark, and Tulia.
Seems to make some sense there, Rich. The various versions of that tube, 6146A, B, and the other numbers you mentioned, all have a little bit of difference of control grid capacitance, plate capacitance, and the coupling coefficient between plate and control grid. And so it is that balance that is being created by your neutralization network. When you study a neutralization network and you understand phasing of the circuit that's at the grid and the phasing of the circuit that's at the plate, you study a network and it looks like positive feedback. It looks like it's trying to make your tube into an oscillator. What's really going on is that the feedback from plate to control grid is a kind of negative feedback, but because of the tuning of the plate circuit and the tuning of the grid circuit, you can easily end up with a tuned grid, tuned plate oscillator, or something that's close to oscillating and it rings, if you don't neutralize. Once you neutralize, once you adjust the neutralization correctly, the tube thinks it has no capacitance coupling between plate circuit and grid circuit. They become thoroughly isolated. It's called a unilateralizing adjustment. In other words, the signal flows through in one direction and doesn't flow back again. One method of adjusting neutralization is to not put on the B plus, but plug in the tube, turn on the filament, apply a nice loud signal to the plate circuit, feed the amplifier backwards, apply a nice loud signal to the plate circuit, properly resonate the plate circuit, properly resonate the grid circuit, and look at what voltage with a sensor-to-sensor you can detect on the input circuit. So you apply a strong signal to the output connector, with the V-plus turned off, and you look at what, with a sensor-to-detector, what voltage you see on the input circuit, maybe the input connector of the whole amplifier, adjust the neutralization until that signal goes to zero, goes to a null, and now you've got an amplifier where the only way the signal can go from the input to the output is to go through the gain function of the tube, and all other coupling characteristics have been neutralized, have been made to cancel each other, so to speak. So as I said, it looks like positive feedback. Well, that's a careful adjustment if you want to do a really good job. It's a careful balancing act. And you plug in a tube that's got a different amount of coupling capacitance between plate and grid, and what would be a great neutralization becomes unneutralized. So I think that's a major reason why there are certain model numbers of tubes that are supposed to be used with certain rigs. Now, a smart amateur who maybe has access to 6146 Bravos, and maybe the Bravo is a little bit more rugged, and he likes the fact that it's got a little bit more power output, if he's smart enough, he can readjust his neutralization network and bring it back into neutralization with the new tube. I want
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Rich, I wonder if you've ever heard of anyone re-neutralizing the rig after they plugged in a different model number of tube. N2EO, KQLIW, the deck man.
Okay, Dick. I tried that myself, and I got the same results that this article I read was that within a few days or a week, depending how much operation, the neutralization tends to drift out and can't neutralize it anymore. Apparently there's some damage to the V tube, and I don't know why, in these earlier rigs. What Collins recommends you do is disable the plate, disable the screen voltage, put a 50-ohm load on the output, and use either an RF probe, or in my case, I used an oscilloscope with a probe connected to the output, and adjust the plate tuning and plate loading for maximum deflection, and then set the neutralization for minimum feed through. I did that on the 6146B, and it did not hold up. I did it on a pair of 6146As, later a pair of 6293s, and it's working fine. But I've got in there now a pair of RCA 6293s and a KWM2. I'm getting about 125 watts out, even on 10 meters, or less on 10 actually. And it's working fine, and it's been in there now a good month. That's good, Dick.
Okay, why coming?
As Mel recognized twice, the fact that the neutralization drifted is a bit mysterious to me, because what you're neutralizing is the plate to control grid coupling capacitors within the tube. And unless something is really moving physically inside the tube, I'm having trouble believing that that capacitance changes. I bet you've done neutralization of the other kind of tube, Mel, and I bet if it was done right, it worked. Let's find out. K2KEY,
K2LIW. Hi, Jeff. This is K2KEY. I picked up a number of 6146s that were intended for heavy military service, Mobile heavy military service. What they did is they beefed up the support that holds the grid circuit together and the screen circuit. They beefed that up, which changed what is known as, and has been actually designed, is what we call the CGP, capital C with a little GP, is the capacitance of the grid-to-plate capacitance. Because what happens with the heavier one, you'll find that the grid current in milliamps has changed. You have to readjust your, have to redo slightly change the method of biasing the grid, the resistor that controls the grid current, I remember correctly, what this measurement was. On the 6146 is originally A, I think they were drawing About 2.5 mils. Yeah, about 2.5 mils. On the heavier, the newer version, it draws about, I think around 4.2. So I modified, I made a number of modifications in it, and I've been running them on a number of Collins radios now. And no problem whatsoever with any problem with neutralization. You just got to know where to look, Dick, over.
Now, I think you're adjusting the control grid current with a standard amount of drive. Were you also readjusting, if this is a linear amplifier, sideband linear amplifier, were you adjusting the standby bias current, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, the, like I say, the tube, you got to look at the tube a little different. It's a 6146 in number. Construction-wise, they made a number of changes. And the major change is that what is changing there is your D, like I say, GP. That's the capacitance between grid and plate. So when you change that, you're going to change the number of the values of a few capacitors. I don't remember what I changed. I remember I changed a couple of capacitors and changed a couple of resistors. I know I modified the output somewhat. Get a little bit more power out of them. I mean, maybe the old ones, some of them went down, but I noticed they get a little bit more power out of them. The original 6146 that were in there, I think, what the heck did I measure? What did I get inside? Maybe a 40, 70 watt, 70, something, remember now. I think about peak 70 watts, something like that. I think I get a little bit more out of these newer ones, the newer style, Dick, but they've been in there now for a number of years, and I use it only on CW, boy, oh boy, they're still hanging on real well, Dick, over.
Sounds reasonable. Where you saw what you thought was a crawling condition, Rich, I wonder if there was a little bit of gas in those particular tubes. When a tube becomes a little bit gassy, either at the time of manufacture or downrange or very slow leak of some kind, boy, they can become kind of squirrely. Need time to turn it on or rig behaves a little bit differently. I've had some gassy tubes in my time, and so that can kind of drive you up a wall. And if you do neutralization on a gassy tube, I think there's a slim possibility that some of the neutralization could drift. But there I'm not absolutely sure. Okay, we'll be investigating that more as time goes on. Eugene, I know you wanted to say something. W2EWK, how things are in your neighborhood, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Things can't be any better what it is now, W2EWK. I know what the answer is. I know what you're going to tell me, but I want to get it from you, though, because you're the man, you know. What it is, if you go to the ocean and transmit from your car, will you get out real, real good from the ocean, or you're better off on a very, very high hill or mountain? Where would you be best? Where to transmit from for HF? That's my question. W2WK back to net. Oh.
Interesting question, Eugene. I think the answer is a little bit like, it's going to sound crazy at first, the person who asked, will I be happier if I marry a lady who's a blonde or if I marry a lady who's a brunette or a redhead? In both cases, there's quite a few more variables than first meets the eye. In general, when you're higher up, you do better, with rare exceptions. For real good radiating, height helps a whole lot. But there's exceptions to that rule. The guys who do 10 gigahertz work have discovered on a number of occasions that if they're on a real high mountain, on 10 gigahertz, they get out like gangbusters. Come halfway down the mountain, things don't work as well as they should. Get down to sea level, drive over to a seashore, and transmit over the water, and again, the signal gets real strong again. In the case of 10 gigahertz, the layer of moist air close to the water creates a downward bending of the wave, and as such, the wave can follow Earth's curvature, and you can talk to somebody many times beyond your radio horizon when you're down at the seashore on a day when it's not too windy. So there were times when being down low helped. That's a 10 gigahertz answer. Now you're about to ask me if I'm in a mobile and I'm on 80 meters, when you're at the seashore, you've got a real good local ground. And depending on your particular takeoff angle, that could give you a stronger signal that particular day. And if you drove up the mountain, you may find that halfway up the mountain it's not so good, and up at the top of the mountain, from a different point of view, it gets good again. So I don't think there is a completely broadband answer, seashore versus mountaintop. But I'm not an HF man. And the guys who have dwelled a lot on HF is Mel's group of guys. Mel, if you had the choice of seashore or mountaintop for your field day operation, and you want to make the most number of QSOs on 80 to 10 meters, which one would you choose? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is an experiment. Many a time. Mobile. I've been mobile in action for many, many years. And what I have done is drag myself to some unusual location. And the one that was the most surprising was when I went up to a place upstate New York called High Point. Now, High Point is where three states, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, come together. This monument that's up there has the highest point in three states. And I talked to the ranger when I got up there, because you can't really drive right up to the monument area. It's like a parking area right there, right next to the monument. Not, you know, like maybe 100 feet below the monument. And I spoke to the ranger, there's a road that goes up there that they had, you know, have it closed. And I said to my hand radio operator, I'd like to just try it out. And he was very interested, you know, in seeing what I have there. I said, come on, let me go up there and I'll show you how this operates, the mobile and everything. And I got up there and I thought at that out of, I think it's 1,800 feet. Well, it's going to be wonderful. It worked. Yeah, I made contacts and everything. But I'll tell you something. Consistently, when I used to operate the contest of the mobile just to see how many countries I could rack up in a mobile, my favorite spot was to go out to a place here, Marine Park, for two reasons. One, they had a lot of radios buried underneath the field there. And number two, the water is right there. And in fact, a number of the guys in the club and everything go to Floyd Bennett and they park by the water right there, and they all say that it seems like they tried the mountains and all, and I again, from the mobile, I'll take like along the Belt Parkway with the ocean near me and everything. I've worked a lot of DX every day, mobiling back and forth, so I think if HF mobiling, I'll take the water deck or any time over.
KC2QAQ with comment.
So you tell me I should drive down to the ocean and take my ground for my car and throw it in the middle of the ocean, and that should give me a good ground plane. Is that correct, W2WK?
Well, you take the ship to sea. Worked a lot of the maritime mobiles, especially there's a lot of them still operating from the commercial shipping of Russia. They're still operating on CW, still using CW, and I've worked a lot of them all over the world, and they do basically get through it, like on 80 meters CW, which is one of the only bands that are open at night. They are the ones that get through basically consistently. They're maritime mobile out in the middle of the Atlantic, Pacific, or the Indian Ocean, Eugene, over.
Okay, let's see what Glenn's got to say. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hey, just a quick comment. Last year at field day, I was in my mobile, and I was down at Jones Beach for most of the day during the day fun. And I have to say that the propagation of the beach was fantastic last field day. I can't speak about the mountaintop, but I can tell you one thing. In the evening, one of the things that actually drove me out of the parking area, the police wouldn't stay there after hours because they knew what I was doing, but it was actually the bugs that drove me out. So I was trying to keep the windows out inside the truck, and I was getting bitten alive by mosquitoes. So you're going to go by the seashore area, bring some bug spray. Back to you, sir, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I've got a guess to see what I think is going on here. when you set up a quarter wave ground plane antenna in your backyard, we've all just about agreed that something like 30 to 100 radials are required if you want very high efficiency. If you don't want to be coupling a lot of your RF energy into the earth, which acts like a dummy load. In the case of an automobile, you don't have that option. The only counterpoise you've got, the only bedrock that the antenna is working on, so to speak, is the automobile itself, which at 80 through 10 meters is nowhere near big enough, particularly on 80 and 160. So the automobile is working with a very marginal ground plane system. Therefore, the higher the conductivity of the dirt that's under the automobile, the better. So when you get down to the seashore where you've got salt water nearby, you've got a rather good conducting surface below the automobile, and I am guessing that that's the reason why it works so much better. From the evidence you've seen, do you think that's that is a possible explanation, Mel? A2KE1, K2LIW?
Roger. In fact, I'm going to tell you about a contact, very interesting guy that gets on every so often, on ACW. He is a VR, JC. He operates from one of the little islands there. He's in the military. He's stationed on Diego Garcia, an island that the United States uses in the Indian Ocean to store military equipment for emergency transportation anywhere in the world. It's a strategic spot, basically. So when he has a day off or something, he gets in his boat and he goes off to one of these little islands, any one of these little islands, with his 706 and his battery, and he stays on the air on CW only, strings up a wire between two palm trees or whatever, and he gets on, and it's amazing that I work him. Now, he's only running a small radio there and a thing, but he says usually he's on an island, a lot of those little islands that he activates, and there, some of them are only maybe couple hundred feet in circumference or less. And the reason is, I only can say how I'm hearing him and how I work him that well, that John Clancy, he is that that's because he's surrounded by water. He's actually with water basically over him. I would say at times maybe just under him, but how else can you account for a radio that, well, it could run a maximum of 100 watts, which I doubt if he ever runs it at that. But getting through consistently, Dick, other than there has to be the seawater as the constant, over.
Looks like we've got a reasonable sounding answer, and maybe that's a big portion of it, Eugene. And Eugene's going to run his experiment of seashore versus mountaintop. Let's see what he sees. He's going to report back to us. I think I heard Paul sign in earlier, WS2N. I wonder if there is a space report you'd like to give us today, Paul. Let's find out. WS2N, if you're there, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I got a comment on the space report, a very important comment.
Okay, Dick, want Eugene to take it? WS2N.
Okay, Eugene, say your words about the space report and then turn it over to Paul. You got it, Eugene.
Okay, I just want to say a couple of things about space. I was very shocked when I listened to the science panel tonight. They said on the science panel, when they went to the moon, and when they, you know, went from the mothership to the moon, the machine where they go back to the mothership, the fuse broke on it, you know. And they had to use a pen to jam it into the fuse to make it work. And they didn't think that it was going to get back to the mothership. And the president of the United States had a speech to make if that happened. But thank God everything went pretty smooth that they got back to the mothership. That's my comment, W2WK Clear.
Eugene, can you tell us where you read that report?
Okay, I read that report on the science channel on TV.
Okay. Paul, I wonder if you've heard about that one. WS2N, K2RIW. And Paul, don't forget, every 2 minutes or so, you got to drop.
Okay, understood, Dick. Yeah, I believe that was Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong, put a pen into one of the circuit breakers that failed. Some of the little quirks, things that went wrong. I haven't read that in the past. I'll research it, find out what circuit breaker it was and all of that, but pretty good that they had that on the TV. There was quite a bit of problems with Apollo 11, with the radar and computers being overloaded. They almost aborted a couple of times. Quite a bit of problems, including getting back. I believe that was the Apollo 11, Eugene. Dick, yeah, I just wanted to bring up 2 weeks from now, the 25th, you're going to have the Phoenix landing of the onto Mars, the northern hemisphere of Mars, land there and in one location, and they plan on digging into the ground and looking for ice and organic material, and it should be pretty interesting a couple of weeks from now. Actually, 2 weeks from today, we are. I'm not sure if it's in the daytime or nighttime, I'll have to check. Could even be during the net here, I don't know, Dick. One other comment I want to make, I saw a good show recently regarding the telescopes that were built in Chile, on that desert, Palomar, I think the location is, the desert where it rains only a very, very few days per year, if at all. Good job. They were talking about the VLT, the very large telescope built by the European Space Agency, contracted by them, $500 million project. Many countries involved, including the U.S. And they show these four telescopes built on this mountaintop, 20 years in the making, from concept to completion, and they work on the lens, the mirrors that they made, some of the largest mirrors that they made. They combine all four of these telescopes using interferometry, and the end result is pictures that are supposed to be about 50 times better than a Hubble Space Telescope. They show these mirrors. They're not built in with this hexagon shape, you know, multi-mirror pieces similar to a Keck telescope in Hawaii. These are one big mirror formed in a piece of glass. So it's a little different than that. Interesting thing about it is they're on the thin side, so they are able to bend and twist, and they have hundreds of these hydraulic pistons underneath, which actually just bend and move the glass, similar to like a contact lens in your eye. So you would push on one side, the mirror will actually bend, and they call it active optics. Through the system, they're able to help to eliminate the problems with the atmosphere and get really clear pictures. No matter what they do, this thing will compensate the temperature and the twisting of the mirror one way or the other. Let me drop it there. They did show the interferometry diagram, more or less, of the four telescopes lined up and you know, coming out of each one and then eventually ganging together and making one image. You know, when I always thought of optics, telescope that was to say, oh, it would make it three or four times as big if you put four of these telescopes together, similar to a mirror that was four times as big. The way it made it looked like one picture would be actually overlaying over the other one. By the time they're done, they'd get four pictures of these, you know, coming from each telescope and actually overlapping one another and coming up with a picture in that fashion. Not like they're all in one big gigantic diameter mirror. By the way, each one of these mirrors, I think, like 30 feet or something like that. I think it was 8 meters. I think it was around 8 point something meters each mirror. So it wasn't like, you know, you would take the diameter of four of these and, you know, wind up with 32 meters in diameter. It was more like you would take each mirror and it would be like taking many photographs, say four photographs, and putting one over the other. And that's the reason they get these superb pictures. They didn't explain if it was electronic. Did the picture go into the charge coupled device, which probably does, and then send that signal to, you know, gang all these together and make one picture? Or was it actually, you know, were they taking the photo, the actual picture from each telescope using mirrors and focusing it all onto one charged couple device? They really didn't explain that one way or the other, but maybe you know. And maybe you can give us an idea of the difference between optic and radio telescope interferometry. Is there what's the difference? Is there a difference, or is it all electronic, or is one really optic all the way to the final charge couple device? They call it the Very Large Telescope in Chile. Four of them gang together. Back to you there, Dick. WSUM.
Yeah, the Very Large Telescope you're talking about, the interferometer that's being operated in Chile, is at Paranel, is the name of the location, is the name of the mountain range. It's operated by the European Southern Observatory, ESO. If you simply Google ESO or European Southern Observatory, you'll get some beautiful pictures of that installation. Manfred Mortenrig. Mel, tell me his call letters because I keep forgetting them.
XQ2FOD.
Well done. I knew he would be able to do that. XQ2FOD, that's his call letters. He's the guy who I've communicated with a whole lot because he's a real power supply expert, switching power supply expert, and he maintains an awful lot of the electronics up there. Now, what's going on? Ground-based telescopes are now heavily challenging what Hubble can do. I didn't say they're better. Each has its own capability. The huge advantage that Hubble has is that it's above the atmosphere. When it comes to infrared, ultraviolet, and whatever, the atmosphere is a significant blockage, and the fact that Hubble is above the atmosphere gives it a huge advantage. However, there are ground-based telescopes which can give you a very large amount of area. Therefore, when it comes to capturing all those very weak photons that were emitted tens of billions of years ago, you want as much area as possible, but you want all of that area to be focused. And here's the catch. The atmosphere is a disturbing medium. If, for instance, you threw a quarter into the bottom of your pool, and you try to take a photograph of that quarter in the bottom of your pool while you're standing above the water on the edge of the pool, you would see the quarter appears to be shimmering, seems to be moving around. And that's because the water is really moving because the wind is blowing. So the surface of the water in your pool never really sits still. Turns out our atmosphere does the exact same thing. The atmosphere is a few tens of miles thick, and the atmosphere is always moving. So it's slowly distorting that thing you're looking at. The stars you watch twinkle because of what the atmosphere does. There's something called adaptive optics. You now make some portion of the mirror system of your telescope, let me drop, into an adaptive optics lens. It really is a kind of a reflecting device made out of thin materials with a whole lot of individual actuators. And those individual actuators are moving in millisecond time periods. So if you have a guide star, if you have a star that's in the field of view that's bright enough, and you keep distorting the mirror in such a way that you get the sharpest possible picture of that star, then you are cranking back out the distortion that the atmosphere is creating on a millisecond by millisecond period of time. Do that correctly, and you get a huge improvement in sensitivity, resolution, and whatever. The telescope starts acting almost as if it is above the atmosphere, because you've taken out the atmospheric distortion dynamically. That's what adaptive optics is capable of doing. Well, a lot of times you want to take an astronomical picture in the direction where there isn't a large local guide star in the field of view. Well, you can create your own guide star. If you take a look at the April issue of Smithsonian Magazine, the lead article, it's on the front cover. It's about the black hole research that's going on in the center of our galaxy. That particular telescope, they describe to you the fact that they use a laser beam alongside of the telescope to excite the sodium ions that are in the top of our atmosphere that were deposited there by meteorites, and those sodium ions will glow when they're hit with the laser light. The laser light that's alongside of the telescope creates an artificial guide star at the top of our atmosphere. So they use the artificial star they've created with the adaptive optics, make that picture as clear as possible. Then they're taking out most of the effect of the atmosphere in that vicinity. And that's been done fairly successfully. So that technique is getting better and better as time goes on. The really large telescopes these days, let me drop, do not consist of one single piece of glass. The single largest piece of glass that I know about is the 200-inch mirror that's used at Mount Palomar. And I've actually gone to Mount Palomar and seen that piece of glass. And when Corning Works made that piece of glass way back in the 30s, it was a big deal. To try to make bigger telescopes out of a bigger piece of glass is essentially out of the question. Nowadays, we build a whole lot of individual hexagonal chunks of glass and fit them all together very carefully. By laser range-finding techniques, you can precisely aim dynamically the individual hexagonal sections of your mirror. The Keck telescope, which is one of the largest telescopes in Hawaii right now, is made of, I think, 36 individual pieces of glass. And those 36 individual pieces of glass have all had their little actuators connected to them so that it can connect, it can correct for gravity loading, temperature differences, and everything else. In other words, they can now synthesize a huge mirror way beyond what you could pour in any one piece of glass by making it out of individual pieces. So you combine the combination of individual pieces of glass for the main reflector and adaptive optics. You put that all together, and on the ground, you can produce some really big telescopes. And they're in the talking phase right now of producing a 30-meter diameter telescope. That's a 100-foot diameter mirror. They're in the talking phase of doing that right now, and I'm trying to remember who I read about that's funding that. Oh, yes. What the heck's the guy's name? Mr. Moore, the guy who invented Moore's Law. No, Moore's Law states that, and he started this in the late 60s, he said that every year we will double the number of transistors we put into a microprocessor. And here we are 35, 40 years downrange, and his law still holds. He is the creator of Intel and Fairchild Semiconductor and whatever. I think they said he's worth $35 billion. And he is now putting a substantial amount of his funding into a telescope that's going to be 30 meters in diameter. Obviously not one single piece of glass when he drops. It's going to be a whole bunch of individual pieces of glass. So it's going to be a combination of a telescope that has individual pieces carefully tuned, carefully ground, along with adaptive optics. Now, when it comes to the spacecraft that's going to land on Mars in a couple of weeks, beautiful article that was in Newsday yesterday, page 57, I think it was, about Tony Priera. I'm not quite sure how Tony pronounces his last name. Beautiful picture of him. You can go to his website. Spectrum Thin Film is the name of his company. His website is photonics.com. Yeah, if you go to photonics.com,